Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
It's the morning show. I'm John Munson. 80 years ago tonight, an unsponsored radio program shocked the world with a fake news broadcast about a Martian invasion. Why did people think Martians were really invading? That's one of the questions we'll ask. Norman Gilliland, host of old-time radio drama on WPR, joins me to talk about The War of the Worlds.
Ladies and gentlemen, the director of the Mercury Theater and star of these broadcasts, Orson Welles.
Norman Gilliland, host of old-time radio drama for Wisconsin Public Radio, also produces WPR's University of the Air and reads for Chapter Day. Norman, good morning.
Good morning, John Bunsen.
So 80 years ago tonight, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 7 o'clock here in the middle part of the country, this CBS broadcast goes on the air, and things escalate rapidly from there. I, for those who don't remember or have any idea what we're talking about, tell us, what happened October 30th, 1938? What was War of the Worlds?
War of the Worlds was a drama that was put together in the course of about 6 days, an adaptation of the 1898 novella by H.G. Wells, different spelling, no relation to Orson. And it was a work that was put together by a bit of a committee, but Orson Welles had pretty much the final say before the CBS censors made some little adjustments, and it was a dramatized invasion by Martians of the Earth.
How many people do we think were listening to this program?
Well, you know, the numbers vary, but I think 3 million is probably about right, which was a small audience compared to the opposing show on the other network, the Chase and Sanborn Hour, Bergen and McCarthy.
Yeah, Edgar Bergen, he owned that time slot. So how then did people end up, let's back up a second. How was this program received by the listeners who heard it right from the beginning?
Well, that is an important part of the equation, John. And those who heard it from the beginning, including one that I talked to once upon a time, said, yeah, it was a radio play. It was, you know, exciting. It was well done, as Orson Welles' plays tended to be. And that was that.
Well, we might think, we maybe look back on this and kind of laugh at how credulous people were. Maybe it was silly for people to mistake a radio play for an actual news broadcast about a Martian attack. But let's do a little scene setting here, Norman. 1938, not exactly a tranquil period in world or American history.
Yeah, you remember what FDR said in his inaugural address in 1933, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. There was a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety, justifiable fear and anxiety in the air worldwide and in this country too, with Europe on the brink of war, with the Munich Pact ceding part of Czechoslovakia to Germany, and Hitler seemingly unstoppable in his demands, and this kind of monolithic German force slowly taking over Europe, and it would soon accelerate, of course. And we were still in a depression. People had a lot of anxiety about that. There was fear of Bolshevism or communism in this country, fear of labor strikes, and all kinds of things to be afraid of.
So when Orson Welles, in his opening monologue, says, you know, that the war scare was over and that things were getting better, more people were back at work, business was picking up, none of that was true. So that was really a fake news broadcast at that point. And then, a lot of people were listening to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. So did some people then, why did they leave that program and switch over to the Mercury Theater?
Well, apparently there weren't a lot of them who did that, John, but there were some. And Bergen and McCarthy were very entertaining. Edgar Bergen was a ventriloquist, and Charlie McCarthy was one of his sassy alter egos. And you wouldn't think ventriloquism would work on radio. I mean, you know, read my lips.
Juggling on the radio.
Yeah, but he was wildly successful, and it was a variety show. And then at a certain point, a few minutes into the Bergen and McCarthy show, Nelson Eddy, the singer, famous for various things, Indian Love Call and some other songs, comes on and starts singing in this kind of pseudo-operatic style, which did drive some listeners late over to the other show, which happened to be a War of the Worlds.
And then, if they timed it right, they might have switched just in time to hear this.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars.
So we hear about explosions of gas on the planet Mars. This was an interruption to programming. Pay attention to that. What do we know about what was going through people's minds at this point?
Well, of course, there were bulletins coming in from time to time from Europe. And so, again, people were kind of on edge. And radio was their main source of immediate information. You're not going to get it from the newspaper, even from, you know, a special edition, a late edition, as quickly as you could on radio. So radio was a very powerful and dramatic force for bringing information to people, whether it was true or, in this case, false.
And there wasn't a radio journalism at that point. It was really in its infancy, and they didn't really have reporters. They had a lot of commentators. We'll hear from one of those in a little bit. One of the characters in this radio play is a commentator by the name of Carl Phillips. Spoiler alert, he dies in the first act, but then I've experienced that on stage a few times, so I know what it is.
The rumors are rife, John.
Yeah. So, again, the program noted right off the bat that this was a theatrical production, yet people were still confused, some of those who listened from the beginning or weren't paying attention, and some of those who came in late. But let's talk about the production behind The War of the Worlds, starting with Orson Welles and his Mercury Theater Company, the one that he founded. Orson Welles, we claim him as a Wisconsin native. he was, what, 23 when he did this?
That's right.
He was a sensation. Tell us about Orson Welles.
Well, he was born in Kenosha, though he was never very attached to Kenosha. He was written up in the Wisconsin newspaper, the State Journal, I think it was, at the age of 10 as being a wunderkind. There was a picture of the 10-year-old Orson Welles. He went to summer camp in Madison for a time, did not adjust very well. But at a very early age, early teens, was already making a name for himself as an actor here and in Great Britain. And largely by a bit of bluffing and a lot of talent. And he was a very focused individual once you got him into a theatrical production, and was possibly the most brilliant of all radio actors.
And he had a lot of acting gigs. Of course, he was the voice of the Shadow, and he tells stories later that he used to take a lot of taxis from one show to the other, and a lot of things, you know, walk in, grab a script, and start performing.
He also, you know, he discovered that he could hire an ambulance to get him across New York even faster.
Well, that's clever. You mentioned that this was put together in a pretty brief period of time.
6 days, yeah.
6 days, well, but really, didn't Orson Welles see the Howard Koch script kind of for the first time on the Friday before the broadcast?
Yeah, that's right. It was within a day or so of the broadcast, and he's said, as Koch had thought also, and John Houseman, who had worked with Koch on the script, oh, it's dull. You know, it's dull. So Orson starts applying some techniques that he had and others had used in England in the 20s before, and tightened it up and put in these newscasts and in other places, though he spread it out to make it the suspense almost painfully exciting, in terms of you hear these long musical interludes and you wonder what's going on, and then he breaks in, of course, with the latest bulletin.
Well, speaking of bulletins, I want to play another clip from the broadcast. Carl Phillips, a commentator, is supposed to sound like he's reporting live as the disaster unfolds. Let's listen to that.
Wait a minute. Something's happening. Humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Ah! Oh, the whole field's caught up by the woods, the fires, the gas tanks for the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
So Carl Phillips meets his end, but what was his character, or who was his character modeled after?
Well, Herb Morrison, who had been covering live the descent of the Zeppelin, the dirigible, the Hindenburg in Lakehurst, New Jersey, just the previous year in 1937. And it's a very famous clip. Herb was out there to record sound effects, which was a new concept at the time. And suddenly he has this major disaster that he is recording and voicing, "Oh, the Humanity," the famous line from that. And Frank Reddick, who played Carl Phillips in War of the Worlds, listened to Herb Morrison's recording of that actuality over and over to get it just right. And so, you know, when you think about people who had heard, or in some cases seen, the newsreel of the Hindenburg, and just a year later, they're hearing something like Carl Phillips reporting and getting incinerated by Martians, not so big a leap for some people.
Well, I mean, I knew what was going on, and I still get chills when I hear him talk about the advancing flames, and then all of a sudden he's cut off, and Orson Welles leaves a big gap of silence before he has an announcer come in and basically say, "Something's wrong with our connection."
Yeah, very pregnant pause, very effective.
Yeah, our commentator just got incinerated.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, well, it's tough to find people to fill in when they keep getting incinerated. How did the sound and format of the show influence how people received it?
Well, of course, there's a whole spectrum of the way people received it. There were, you know, some of the people you can fool all of the time. So there were some of those who anxiously called newspapers and police stations to know what was going on. There was nobody, you know, running around crazy in the streets that we can tell. Nobody died. There were no suicides, and perhaps not even any injuries.
People weren't jumping out of upper story windows. But there are some stories about people, what people did do, and we'll get to those when we continue our conversation. 80th anniversary of the original CBS broadcast of War of the Worlds. Norman Gilliland, host of WPR's old-time radio drama, is here to share with us what he knows about it. You can, too, at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson.
This time we take you to Washington for a special broadcast on the national emergency. The Secretary of the Interior.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people.
We're talking about the War of the Worlds broadcast, 1938, 80 years ago. Norman Gilliland is with us, host of WPR's old-time radio drama. Norman, we just heard from the show's fictional Secretary of the Interior, who sounds a lot like a real person that people all knew. Who was he supposed to sound like?
Yeah, Kenny Delmar, who was a veteran radio announcer, was emulating Franklin D. Roosevelt.
And this was intentional?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, again, for credibility. You know, they pulled back a lot of, because of CBS made them do it the last minute, a lot of the actual names, place names and people names in War of the Worlds. And so, you know, this was one way that they could make it sound more immediate, more realistic, was to have Kenny Delmar sound like FDR. Who used radio a lot, of course.
Right. And yeah, the fireside chats, yeah. He understood the power of radio, and he applied it effectively, and apparently so did Orson Welles. Did Welles have any idea how people would react to this thing? Do we know that?
Well, we know what he said, but, you know, Welles, it was all about the story with Welles, whether it was a play or a newspaper interview. And he said, you know, the morning after, "I had no idea." It may be true, but he was after a dramatic effect, and he was after immediacy, and he certainly knew how to get them.
Well, much later in life, he claimed he did the whole thing on purpose, that he was concerned about how credulous people were, how they believed everything they heard on the radio, and he wanted to give them a dose of something that might make them think twice. But then that was something he said many years after the fact, so discount it a little.
He was known to say various things over the course of time.
Well, he did understand marketing. During the broadcast, after learning how freaked out some people were and all the calls CBS got, the network network did ask Welles to do a station break to let people know that it was just a radio play. How did Welles respond to that?
Well, you mentioned at the top, John, that this was a not a sponsored show. It was a sustained show, and so there were no commercial breaks that had to be written into the script at any particular time. Typically, it would have been at the half-hour mark for a commercial, not necessarily with this script. And so there was a break due in about 10 minutes or at the 40-minute mark. And so Welles just kind of blew right through that half hour and waited till the 40-minute mark to make the announcement. So that much more suspense, you might say, for those who were tuned in.
And that's why he did it, to build more suspense.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it was all about the play for Orson Welles. You don't break into a really good play or even a so-so play, in his opinion, and, just to stick in a commercial or some arbitrary break.
Well, and in this case, I mean, if he does break that, then the whole rest of the first act is kind of pointless.
Yeah, and there's a natural break there, too, where it goes from the Carl Phillips and the kind of immediacy and the news breaks to really a more conventional drama with Professor Pearson, played by Orson Welles, in dialogue and monologue.
Yeah, he kind of carries the second act, if you will, with his long monologue about wandering through New Jersey and going and meeting the stranger and all of that.
Which, of course, wouldn't work at all as a news piece, as an actuality. I mean, wait a minute, where is this guy broadcasting from?
Right, yeah. And of course, we had the ending there in the first act, and I won't ask for the clip, but we where the announcer is on top of this building in New York. And watching the Martians come closer and the smoke advancing, and then basically we hear the guy die on the air, and then we get the plaintive radio call asking if anybody's there in New York. And then, which is actually kind of cool when you listen to it, then you hear the CBS announcer again, letting us all know that this is a radio play. But for those who did panic, by the time they heard that, they were probably already in their cars headed for the hills, and so they probably missed it, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, those relatively few who did freak out sure would have missed it. They would have not been listening, because we all know the main thing, John, is to listen very carefully to your radio.
Yes, I count on that. Well, actually, I count on people not paying attention some days. But what happened? What was the aftermath of the broadcast?
It was really interesting because, there were something like 12,500 newspaper stories written about it in very short order. There were some people who said, there was a senator in Iowa who said the FCC should start reviewing all broadcasts before they hit the air, and he never really followed through on that. The FCC, however, had a very much of a hands-off attitude toward it. They did not press, there were no charges, there were no fines. In fact, they barred anyone from suing CBS because of War of the Worlds.
But the network agreed they weren't going to do any more fake newscasts, didn't they?
Not that convincing, no.
Yeah, okay. But how did the War of the Worlds affect Welles' career? Did he suffer consequences?
Yeah, for him, really good consequences. I mean, his career took off like a rocket. I mean, he was already famous around New York, but then he became internationally famous.
He got an RKO picture deal.
For a little show called Citizen Kane.
So, I mean, actually, you could kind of draw a line between what happened with the publicity from War of the Worlds and the production of Citizen Kane. So one might say that without War of the Worlds, we might never have seen that film.
He used some of the same kind of newsreel techniques at the beginning of Citizen Kane.
So, if it worked once,
Yeah, although in the theater, nobody's going to obviously take it too realistically. But
Did we learn anything from what Welles did here? Did we learn a lesson about how we consume media, or did he do more harm than good?
Oh, I think perhaps unintentionally it was an object lesson, not to be too gullible and not to believe right away what you hear, but to sit back and do a little more thinking about it.
What would be the modern equivalent of something like this? Is there a way that somebody could pull off something like this again, do you think?
Yeah, they could. Yeah, because Welles was using cutting-edge technology and technology failures of his time. All you have to do is translate it over to the internet or some other form of communication that we have today. and with the same kind of news presentation style and the same kind of pseudo fact gathering, yeah, you could pull it off.
The you know, when we listen to unfortunately the recordings that we have are pretty scratchy, and you know, we weren't doing the industry wasn't doing maybe as good a job of preserving some of its audio in 1938 that we do now, but even so, when we listen to it today and when people listen to it, because you've played it on the radio a number of times, what kind of responses do we still get from this?
Oh, well, you know, people love that show, and but I like to remind people that that was just one of a number of Mercury Theater and Campbell Playhouse, pretty much the same show, just sponsored versus unsponsored, that Orson Welles produced. He did a wonderful Dracula in the beginning of the Mercury Theater. He did Treasure Island, Tale of Two Cities, and a whole bunch of shows that are, in some people's minds, even better than War of the Worlds.
And he did Julius Caesar.
He did it with a news presentation format. So there it is again.
And do recordings of some of those other other examples of the Mercury Theater still exist?
Yeah, they're on there. Yeah, you can find them online.
Okay, so we could go and listen to this. Yeah, and I have listened to some of them. I just haven't gotten around
to them. You have to have a good scratchy filter, though. You got to be able to listen through some of those scratches and pops, but it's part of the sound, in my opinion.
It's worth it. I'm trying to imagine what it must have been like in that studio, watching him work and being part of that. It must have been just really exceptional.
Intense.
Yeah. And the orchestra is right there, and you've got
live music.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have anything like that really anymore.
We're trying, John.
Yeah, I know. And you produce a lot of radio drama, and people really enjoy it when you do it. And I'm hoping we can continue that. Norman, thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning to talk about War of the Worlds. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Norman Gilliland hosts old-time radio drama for Wisconsin Public Radio. He also produces WPR's University of the Air, reads for Chapter a Day, and, of course, has been a longtime host of classical music on our NPR News and Classical Music Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. For real, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.